Namaste. Before we begin, I just want to mention that the music from the mother that we listened to this evening on this third day of Navaratri was something that she recorded on this date in 1963, because it is the 19th of October in India. We're sticking to that. So we're continuing in Chapter 11, The Modes of the Self, an essay that Sri Aurobindo published on the 15th of October in 1916. These October dates are redolent in the atmosphere, are they not? We're about midway through the chapter. The self, even the individual self, is different from our personality as it is different from our mental ego sense. Our personality is never the same. It is a constant mutation and various combination. So there are a number of things implanted in these lines. There is a single self. There is no other than a single self. What seems to be, what purports to be, what masquerades as, what forms itself as an individual, is still that one self. When we refer to it as the self, as Atman in Vedantic philosophy, we often mean that still, immeasurable, absolute, unimpeachable, unsegmented reality, which is conscious of its own being. But that individual self that we are has at its core this enormity of expansionless, of endlessly expanding self. This reality is core to us as an individual as well. And yet, that core individuality in us, which is one with that self, is not the moving self that we experience in the universe. Our personality is never the same. Comes, goes, is dim, is bright, always moving. It is what the Gita will describe as the Kshara Purusha. Chapter 15, Shloka 16. Our personality, it is not a basic consciousness, but a development of forms of consciousness. Not a power of being, but a various play of partial powers of being. Not the enjoyer of the self-delight of our existence, Atmarati, but a seeking after various notes and tones of experience which shall more or less render that delight in the mutability of relations. This also is Purusha and Brahman, but it is the mutable Purusha, the phenomenon of the eternal, not its stable reality. The Gita makes a distinction between three persons who constitute the whole state and action of the divine being: the mutable, the immutable, and the highest, which is beyond and embraces the other two. So these would be the Kshara, the mutable, the perishing personality, the akshara, that immutable state of pure being, and Purushottama, the Supreme Being, or Uttama, the Supreme, Purusha, the Person, so the Supreme Person. That Highest is the Lord in whom we have to live, the Supreme Self in us and in all. So let's go to the Gita. There are several passages you might want to look up. In the 8th chapter, the 1st verse. In the 10th chapter, the 9th verse. In the 11th, the 3rd verse. But let's read the 15th chapter and the 18th verse here. Since I am beyond the mutable. This is Krishna as the Supreme speaking. Since I am beyond the mutable, kshara, and am greater and higher even than the immutable, the akshara, in the world and the Veda, I am proclaimed as the Purushottama. So all the world realizes, feels that there is some great thing from which it comes. And those who compose and are knowers of the Veda, who have the real knowledge, perceive that. And it's not the moving and not the unmoving. It is something beyond which contains the two. And of course you'll remember the Mandukya Upanishad. We'll have reference to that shortly as well. Describes the various stages of conscious being and arrives at something beyond even the blissful non-duality of sheer self-absorption, and describes that there is a fourth state, Chaturtham, later called Turiya, in which all these states of waking and dreaming, an absolute absence of duality, all coexist. It goes beyond all measure, beyond the capacity to measure, beyond the capacity to determine, to define, to reflect, to philosophize. Sri Aurobindo continues here. The immutable is the silent, actionless, equal, unchanging self, which we reach when we draw back from activity to passivity, from the play of consciousness and force and the seeking of delight, to the pure and constant basis of consciousness and force and delight, through which the Highest, free, secure, and unattached, possesses and enjoys the play. So he ascribes being and consciousness and delight to both poises, the active poise or the passive poise. And this is something that he knew in the play of his own consciousness, in the settling of his own consciousness, in the stasis and in the dynamis. In the stasis, in 1908, he realized the nirvana as Brahman, the extinguishing of all movement, of all sense of self, in the absoluteness of whatever that is. And then, only a few months later, he realized the omnipresence of a personal divinity, one God that took all forms, of whom the gods are formed, who is nameless but adopts all names, supports all names, and is everywhere you throw your gaze. The mutable is the substance and immediate motive of that changing flux of personality through which the relations of our cosmic life are made possible, hence necessary. The mental being fixed in the mutable moves in its flux and has not possession of an eternal peace and power and self-delight, The soul, fixed in the immutable, holds all these in itself, but cannot act in the world. But the soul that can live in the highest enjoys the eternal peace and power and delight and wideness of being, is not bound in its self-knowledge and self-power by character and personality or by forms of its force and habits of its consciousness, and yet uses them all with a large freedom and power for the self-expression of the divine in the world. So we are bid to raise ourselves beyond the state of freedom from the mutability of the world. Yes, we shall not identify with the personality and its obvious and continual change, but we will not rest simply in the silence of the self. We will ascend still farther into the state of being of the Purushottama. As Krishna says, as Purushottama, take on my nature, my way of being, Madbhavam, be like me. Here again, the change is not in the alteration of the essential modes of the self, but consists in our emergence into the freedom of the highest and the right use of the divine law of our being. So this law of our being, which can be alternatively or simultaneously, as is Shiva in his universal dance, an expression of the power of something supreme. To go to the Gita, this is the station one meets. When you take on, as Krishna bids us, his nature, then you take on the nature of para-prakriti. Not the modes of the gunas that we experience here, mutable, bound to ignorance, but there an affluence, even an affluence of knowledge and power and love and light. Connected with this triple mode of the self is that distinction which Indian philosophy has drawn between the qualitied and the qualityless Brahman, and European thought is made between the personal and the impersonal God. So, Saguna Brahman, Nirguna Brahman. The Upanishad indicates clearly enough the relative nature of this opposition when it speaks of the Supreme as the qualitied who is without qualities. Nirguna, Nirguna Guni. Well, in the Gita also, if you go to chapter 13, shloka 14, you have that. We have again two essential modes, two fundamental aspects, two poles of eternal being, both of them exceeded in the transcendent divine reality. They correspond practically to the silent and the active Brahman. For the whole action of the universe may be regarded from a certain point of view as the expression and shaping out in various ways of the numberless and infinite qualities of the Brahman. If you go to the largest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, count the manners, count the occasions when this Upanishad is declaring, this is Brahman, that is Brahman. It goes on and on and on. You'll lose count. Because it's wondrous in its complexity, it's endless in its enumeration of itself. As Sri Aurobindo describes in The Life Divine, multiplying the one endlessly to the view. While we're there, Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 3:15. Where Sri Aurobindo says, "For the whole action of the universe may be regarded from a certain point of view as the expression and shaping out in various ways of the numberless and infinite qualities of the Brahman," here's that verse. Know that action arises from Brahman. Brahman springs from the imperishable. To continue, his being assumes by conscious will all kinds of properties, shapings of the stuff of conscious being, habits, as it were, of cosmic character and power of dynamic self-consciousness, gunas, into which all the cosmic action can be resolved. So, he has said that the universe is a purposeful creation of Brahman, not accidental. There is a will, a concept behind what seems to be a creation. It is a manifestation of its own being. Is the being of the Supreme pointless? Is the being of the Supreme accidental? If not, then how can the universe, which rises from his being as an intentional device of self-manifestation, be so? We are not here pointlessly, and the universe is not a fluke. But by none of these, nor by all of them, nor by their utmost infinite potentiality is he bound. He is above all his qualities, and on a certain plane of being, rests free from them. This goes back to the life divine, where Sri Aurobindo posits non-being and being as comprehensible by a consciousness that is willing to go beyond the measurements of the mind. The nirguna, or unqualified, is not incapable of qualities. Rather, it is this very nirguna, or no quality, who manifests himself as saguna, as anantaguna, infinite quality, since he contains all in his absolute capacity of boundlessly varied self-revelation. He is free from them in the sense of exceeding them. And indeed, if he were not free from them, they could not be infinite. God would be subject to his qualities, bound by his nature. Prakriti would be supreme, and Purusha its creation and plaything. Of course, there are lovely lines about that play in Savitri, where Sri Aurobindo describes the he and the she. The eternal is bound neither by quality nor by absence of quality, neither by personality nor by impersonality. He is himself beyond all our positive and all our negative definitions. Bhagavad Gita 13, Shloka 27. So, the divine in some ways can be compared to your own being. Going back to the Mandukya Upanishad. When you sit in your own being, deep in meditation, unblinking, not aware of yourself or of other, sheerly absorbed in your being. That's one state. But you are that same being when you begin to conceive, to dream, to deliver into full awareness a beautiful concept. And then bringing that concept into shape, into form, and naming it, empowering that conception in form. That is yet another state. And all of these states of being coexist within you. So too, in the great being, whatever you call it or don't call it, that is that state, chaturtham, which involves, which evolves, which is beyond all of these states. Something there is beyond even the capacity to retire from all movement of awareness. What is that? That you must know. The eternal is bound neither by quality nor absence of quality. It is both saguna and nirguna. It is neither saguna or nirguna. Behold. But if we cannot define the eternal, we can unify ourselves with it. That is yoga. To live in a state of yukta. It has been said that we can become the impersonal, but not the personal God. But this is only true in the sense that no one can become individually the Lord of all the universes. Only the ego wishes to do that anyway. We can free ourselves into the existence of the active Brahman as well as that of the silence. We can live in both, go back to our being in both, but each in its proper way, by becoming one with the nirguna in our essence and one with the saguna in the liberty of our active being, in our nature. Sadharmiya Mukti. That again, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, verse 2. It would mean liberation into a state of likeness with the divine, taking on the nature, dharma, of the divine. And of course, again, this is what Sri Aurobindo accomplished and demonstrated in his life in the earliest years of his sadhana. So the rest of his integral yoga is built out of the suffusion, the mingling, the convergence, is that a word, of one into the other. Nirguna and saguna. If this is true of the divine, it must be true of us. If the divine can manifest the universe and be free of the universe at one and the same time, then we must be capable of that as well, because we are one with that. There is only the one self. There is no division. Drop that illusion. The Supreme pours himself out of an eternal peace, poise, and silence into an eternal activity. Free and infinite, freely fixing for itself its self-determinations, using infinite quality to shape out of it varied combination of quality. We have to go back to that peace, poise, and silence, and act out of it with a divine freedom from the bondage of qualities, but still using qualities, even the most opposite, largely and flexibly, for the divine work in the world. Only, while the Lord acts out of the center of all things, we have to act by transmission of his will and power and self-knowledge. Through the individual center, the soul form of him which we are. The Lord is subject to nothing. The individual soul form is subject to its own highest self. And the greater and more absolute is that subjection, the greater becomes its sense of absolute force and freedom. So without saying it here, the individual at its highest is the Jivatman. This transcendence of sheer personality into that which is one with impersonality and yet a formation of personality which is eternal and timeless. So when we surrender, we free ourselves and liberate this divine power to flow through us. What happens then? The individual, with a receptive, submissive personality here, open like a flower, receives the sunlight of the divine consciousness and transmits it where? Doesn't keep it simply for itself, but into the world around, becomes aglow, radiates the divine light, the force, the delight to all around, beatifying the cosmos as it reaches it, beatifying certainly the context in which it lives, uplifting the society in which it moves. So, if you want to change the world, drop the ego, live in that portion of your high self, which is always at one with the Supreme, and let that flow through you into the world. Not only will you be happy, not only will you be free of the restlessness of the ego, but you will free others through your freedom. The distinction between the personal and the impersonal is substantially the same as the Indian distinction. But the associations of the English words carry within them a certain limitation which is foreign to Indian thought. The personal God of the European religions is a person in the human sense of the word, limited by his qualities, though otherwise possessed of omnipotence and omniscience. It answers to the Indian special conceptions of Shiva or Vishnu or Brahma, or of the divine mother of all, Durga or Kali. And again, we're in Navaratri right now, so Durga and Kali are honored presences. So this business about the personal and the impersonal, if we turn to the prominent thinkers in Protestant theology of the early 20th century with whom Sri Aurobindo would have had some familiarity, like Rudolf Otto. Rudolf was a great theologian and a person who made it powerfully felt that the numinous experience of God is at the core of the theistic religions, where that being is great, stands outside, and you are small, and it is terrific in size. And so you feel the awesome power of what that is. Sri Aurobindo has an accord for that. Yes, the divine is enormous, but it is also infinite beyond the enormity of the form that you feel. So, going back to Eckhart, you have something a little richer than this idea of a great personal being, because for Eckhart, the numinous would reflect the experience of the God. But the mystical experience, where you become one with the being, would reveal to you the Godhead behind the God. So there is this formless, nameless being who seems or surely takes a form, but for self-expression, but always remains what it is beyond all measure. So for Eckhart, there is a resonance that we find in the Vedanta, in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's not like these thoughts are not possible to the European experience and perception. They may not be normal, because how many Eckharts did we have after all? Well, each religion really erects a different personal deity according to its own heart and thought to adore and serve. The fierce and inexorable God of Calvin is a different being from the sweet and loving God of St. Francis, as the gracious Vishnu is different from the terrible, though always loving and beneficent Kali, who has pity even in her slaying and saves by her destructions. Shiva, the god of ascetic renunciation who destroys all things, seems to be a different being from Vishnu and Brahma, who act by grace, love, preservation of the creature, or for life and creation. It is obvious that such conceptions can be, only in a very partial and relative sense, true descriptions of the infinite, omnipresent creator and ruler of the universe. Nor does Indian religious thought affirm them as adequate descriptions. The personal God is not limited by his qualities. He is Ananta Guna, infinite in qualities. Capable of infinite qualities and beyond them and Lord of them, to use them as he will. And he manifests himself in various names and forms of his infinite Godhead, to satisfy the desire and need of the individual soul according to its own nature and personality. It is for this reason that the normal European mind finds it so difficult to understand Indian religion as distinct from Vedantic or Sankhya philosophy, because it cannot easily conceive of a personal God with infinite qualities, a personal God who is not a person, but the sole real person and the source of all personality. Yet that is the only valid and complete truth of the divine personality. The place of the divine personality in our synthesis will best be considered when we come to speak of the yoga of devotion. It is enough here to indicate that it has its place and keeps it in the integral yoga, even when liberation has been attained. Witness Sri Aurobindo's own person and continuing and ever-deepening personal relationship with the Supreme, with the Purushottama. Surrendered to that, in a sense, he became that. There are practically three grades of the approach to the personal deity. The first, in which he is conceived with a particular form or particular qualities as the name and form of the Godhead which our nature and personality prefers. Ishta Devata. A second, in which he is the one real person, the all personality, the Ananta Guna. A third, in which we get back to the ultimate source of all idea and fact of personality, in that which the Upanishad indicates by the single word he, without fixing any attributes. And of course, we begin all of our meetings together with that. Sahana vavatu, sahana bhunatu, sahaviryam karavavahai. May he protect us both together. May he be pleased with us both. May we be filled with spiritual power. May our study together be luminous. May we never hate. He, Saha. You need say no more. That. That, by the way, appears most early, as far as I can see, in the Taittiriya Upanishad. I think it's chapter 11, before the first verse. It's the invocation, it's the Shantipat. It is there that our realizations of the personal and the impersonal divine meet and become one in the utter Godhead. For the impersonal divine is not ultimately an abstraction, or a mere principle, or a mere state or power and degree of being, any more than we ourselves are really such abstractions. The intellect first approaches it through such conceptions, but realization ends by exceeding them. Through the realization of higher and higher principles of being and states of conscious existence, we arrive not at the annihilation of all in a sort of positive zero, even an inexpressible state of existence, but at the transcendent existence itself, which is also the existent, who transcends all definition by personality, and yet is always that which is the essence of personality. When in that we live and have our being, we can possess it in both its modes. The impersonal and a supreme state of being and consciousness, in an infinite impersonality of self-possessing power and bliss, the personal by the divine nature acting through the individual soul form, and by the relation between that and its transcendent and universal self. We may keep even in we may keep even our relation with the personal deity in his forms and names. If, for instance, our work is predominantly a work of love, it is as the Lord of love that we can seek to serve and express him. But we shall have at the same time an integral realization of him in all his names and forms and qualities, and not mistake the front of him, which is prominent in our attitude to the world, for all the infinite Godhead. So this comes again into the realm of the Gita's larger Vedanta and takes us towards the expression of Vedantic truth and that concept of Satchit Ananda, and the realization of Satchit Ananda is our next chapter. Satchit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. But this is a concept that never appeared in the writings of Shankaracharya. This came not from austere Advaita Vedanta, but from theistic Vedanta, that devoted to the Supreme as a person, as a great boundless personality. Both in the form of a he, and simultaneously in the form of a she. For that being has no real gender, but can as validly be seen as the Divine Mother as any other. So we finished this chapter. Next week we'll take up the realization of Satchit Ananda. As you may have noted, it is core to all of Sri Aurobindo's work in the Life Divine and the Synthesis of Yoga. It is all a play of that. Even the supramental existence to which he and the mother aspired to bring down here to earth to transform terrestrial existence is a modality of Satchit Ananda. She conscious, existent, delighted and delightful. So, tonight from Savitri, we're back in book two, the book of the Traveler of the Worlds, and we're in canto one, The World's Stair, and we're on page 96. The heaven hints that invade our earthly lives, the dire imaginations dreamed by hell, which if enacted and experienced here, our dulled capacity soon would cease to feel, or our mortal frailty could not long endure, were set in their sublime proportions there. There, lived out in their self-born atmosphere, they resumed their topless pitch and native power, their fortifying stress upon the soul, bit deep into the ground of consciousness, the passion and purity of their extremes, the absoluteness of their single cry, and the sovereign sweetness or violent poetry of their beautiful or terrible delight. All thought can know, or widest sight perceive, and all that thought and sight can never know. All things occult and rare, remote and strange, were near to heart's contact, felt by spirit sense. Asking for entry at his nature's gates, they crowded the widened spaces of his mind, his self-discovery's flaming witnesses, offering their marvel and their multitude. These now became new portions of himself, the figures of his spirit's greater life, the moving scenery of his large time walk, or the embroidered tissue of his sense. These took the place of intimate human things and moved as close companions of his thoughts, or were his soul's natural environment. Tireless the heart's adventure of delight, endless the kingdoms of the spirit's bliss, unnumbered tones struck from one harmony's strings, each to its wide-winged universal poise, its fathomless feeling of the all-in-one brought notes of some perfection yet unseen, its single retreat into truth's secrecies, its happy sidelight on the infinite. All was found there, the unique has dreamed and made, tinging with ceaseless rapture and surprise, and an opulent beauty of passionate difference, the recurring beat that moments God in time. Only was missing the soul timeless word that carries eternity in its lonely sound, the idea self-luminous key to all ideas, the integer of the spirit's perfect sum that equates the unequal all to the equal one, the single sign interpreting every sign, the absolute index to the absolute. Namaste. Jai Ma.